coming weekend, look for a splash of orange. And if you see a splash of orange, it's most likely an orange sea cucumber. And if you go a little bit deeper down, you might see a big, large red sea cucumber with little spikes on it. And those are going to be your giant sea cucumber or your California sea cucumber, depending on your political philosophy towards naming. But what's really interesting is there's around 30 species in BC waters. I've only ever seen those two, and I've been studying these things for a while. And there's about 1,700 species that have been described around the world. Yeah, they're basically the earthworms of the sea, and they come in all shapes and sizes.
So you've described them just now and before as the earthworms of the sea, and you said that they're important to marine ecosystems. Can you specify like why they are important and what that action is?
Yeah, so they're deposit and suspension feeders. So they feed on waste. And the two species out here in the West Coast are a really good way of sort of illustrating the two different feeding strategies that sea cucumbers have. The giant sea cucumbers are deposit feeders, so they will burrow their way through the sea floor, eating, the bits of other things that have collected there. And then the orange sea cucumbers are suspension feeders. Some people may have seen a couple of viral videos of these beautiful feeding apparatus that they use, and they kind of use their arms to draw in food into their mouths. And they kind of look like a sea anemone in that way. And in this way, they engage in bioturbation. So they're turning up the sediment and they're processing sediment. They're doing nutrient cycling. And so they're very much acting like earthworms in the oceans. And one of my favorite expressions is that every grain of sand in the ocean has at one time passed through a sea cucumber. And that's because they eat a lot and they defecate a lot. There was a study out of Heron Island in Queensland, Australia, a couple of years ago, where they were looking at a 19 square kilometer reef. And they figured out, and they did the math, and they being some fantastic researchers, they figured out that the average sea cucumber defecates around 30 grams a day. And the amount of sea cucumber poop in this one small reef was the equivalent of five Eiffel Towers a year. So they're
Wow.
really important to the marine ecosystems in that respect. And they excrete nitrogen and phosphorus and ammonia. And they also have some really interesting other ecosystem services they provide. One of the ones that a lot of the young listeners might appreciate, and actually I think all listeners might appreciate, is sort of the commensal relationship that some sea cucumbers have in the deep ocean. And there's a fish called the pearlfish. And there's not a lot of places for it to hide in the deep ocean. And so it has created a habitat inside the anal cavity of a sea cucumber species. And it's this interesting relationship between the two animals. And some sea cucumbers don't mind. Some of them have evolved what they call anal teeth to sort of fend off fish. It's this very interesting relationship. But yeah, when we're talking about sea cucumbers, there's a lot of fun poop jokes that some of the young folks find kind of entertaining.
Of course. And you're joining me today. You talked about yourself as an expert in sea cucumber crime. What is sea cucumber crime in your parlance? How would you describe it?
This is a very niche job, right? So there's only about, I think, 8 to 10 people who study crime in sea cucumber fisheries around the world. I'm one of them. My co-author on many papers, Felix Moreau, is another one. I think collectively, when we get together, it counts as almost a quorum of experts in the field. But basically, what sea cucumber crime is it's crime in sea cucumber fisheries. And the reason why we use the term as broadly as possible is it's not just illegally fishing for sea cucumbers. What my work in illegal fishing more broadly has found is that we actually see crime at every stage of the fishery supply chain, whether that's people forging permits or fishing out of season, fishing with illegal gear, fishing over their limits, fishing with forced labor on their boats, to laundering products through legal markets, to lying about where the products came from, to smuggling across borders, to lying on customs forms, to extortion, to bribery, and all other forms of crime. And so when you look at fisheries in general, you can see all this crime. And when we look at sea cucumber fisheries, we see a significant amount of crime around the world. And what's really fascinating and what drew me into this area was Oceans Asia, my marine conservation organization. We've been looking at wildlife crime for a while, marine wildlife crime. And I've been looking at illegal fishing for, gosh, many years now. And what was interesting was one of our focuses, my colleague Gary Stokes, has been studying and working on investigating crime in shark fin fisheries for many years. If anyone's seen the documentary Seaspiracy on Netflix, that's Gary doing his work on shark fins. Eli Roth's documentary Fin takes a deep dive into shark finning. We did a lot of work on that. And the conversation that we had was, okay, so what happens if we win? And progress is being made. Younger generations in Southeast Asia are less interested in eating shark fins. This is a luxury seafood item. The Chinese Communist Party banned it from banquets because it's so expensive. It's seen as a form of bribery. So what happens next? And basically the conversation was, well, the demand for luxury seafood products isn't going to go away. It's likely to shift to other species. What would those be? And we figured that it would likely be the other treasures of Cantonese cuisine. So you've got shark fin, abalone, fish maw, and sea cucumber. Fish maw, for listeners who have never heard that expression, is the swim bladder of the fish. It's the part of the fish that allows it to go up and down in the water column. And these are also a luxury seafood product. And when we looked at the markets for those products, a ton of research had already been done into abalone. There's a really strong connection between abalone trade in South Africa and organized crime syndicates selling methamphetamines and firearms. So we didn't need to do a lot of work there. So the two that we wanted to look at were fish maw and sea cucumbers. And no one was talking about sea cucumbers and crime in those fisheries. So basically, at the beginning of the pandemic, I set up and took a deep dive into the literature, and we've been looking at it ever since.
What have you learned?
Well, we started off by doing a global survey to try to find hotspots. Basically, figure out, look, we know there's crime in the fishery because it's a high-value marine commodity. So where is that crime likely to be? And the biggest hotspot was India and Sri Lanka. So my first paper, it came out, several years ago, looked at crime in Indian and Sri Lankan sea cucumber fisheries. And what was really interesting there is in India, sea cucumber fishing is illegal. In Sri Lanka, it's regulated. And so what you see is people are poaching sea cucumbers in India, bringing them into Sri Lanka illegally, and then laundering them through the legal fish markets there. And then they eventually make their way to Southeast Asia. And that study was really kind of eye-opening for me, the sheer scale of it. Like, we found over the course of only a few years, 120 incidents, 502 arrests, and you're averaging four people per arrest. And what was fascinating about that case was you could actually track the crime as it moved from region to region. This is a trend called the roving bandits, where basically you have buyers that show up in a town and they're like, hey, we're buying sea cucumbers and we're buying them for $2 a sea cucumber. And that's a very attractive deal, especially for folks who are maybe in lower income and developing country situations. And so they start fishing for sea cucumbers. Well, for the sea cucumbers that are there are right on the foreshore, you can pick them up and bring them home, but those quickly disappear. We are talking about the earthworms of the sea. They don't move fast. We're not talking about, you know, fishers chasing after them at high speeds. They're worms. They just chill. So basically, those ones are extirpated quite quickly. And then you end up using divers with the hookah diving method to dive deeper for sea cucumbers. And those are eventually wiped out. And the challenge with sea cucumbers is they're broadcast breeders. And what that means is they need a certain density of animals in one area in order to effectively reproduce. And when that number drops below a certain density, they just don't recover, or they take decades to recover. And so basically, those populations are wiped out. Well, the people who live in that town can't really up and move, but the buyers move on to the next town, and they do what's called, you know, serial exploitation, where they move from town to town, exploiting the population as these roving bandits. And in our work in India and Sri Lanka, we found you could actually just track that, where there was some exploitation in the northern part of Sri Lanka because of low governance following the civil war. And then the crime moved over to Lakshadweep and the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. Basically, you can track it as law enforcement kind of chases it around. The next area we looked at was Mexico, and this was brought to my attention again through looking at news stories, and we weren't able to go into the field because of the pandemic and also safety and budgetary constraints. So we've been looking at mostly news media reports and government reports. And in Mexico, looking at from 2011 to 2021, so 10 years, there was 96 cases, 125 arrests, over 100 tons of sea cucumbers at a value of around $29 million U.S. were being, you know, poached from the ocean. But what was really eye-opening for Mexico was you also have the involvement of cartels and people being murdered and theft and robbery of sea cucumbers. And it was very intense to study some of the cases there. And what got us onto Canadian sea cucumber crime, the paper that I just had come out last week, was journalists kept asking me, well, okay, so there's, you know, lots of cases in India and you've got violence in Mexico. What's going on in Canada? We didn't know. So we set about doing a paper on Canadian sea cucumber crime. It just came out in the recent issue of the Bechtemer Information Bulletin, the premier journal of all things sea cucumber. Incidentally, the only journal of all things sea cucumber. Yeah, and my co-authors and I took a dive into Canadian sea cucumber fisheries between 2015 and 2022.
Right. And in reading that article, there's a lot in there. But one of the big takeaways is that there's a lack of general interest or awareness or sort of coverage of whatever sea cucumber crime there might be. Right.
Yeah. Well, and this is a challenge we have with our work, because basically when people think of wildlife crime, and listeners, think about wildlife crime. The first thing that came to your mind was likely elephants, tigers, lions, maybe rhinoceros, terrestrial charismatic species.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for a good reason, because these are really important species and there's been challenges around protecting them for years. If you're thinking of marine wildlife crime, people are likely going to jump to shark finning, as we've already discussed, maybe whaling, maybe illegal fishing of very charismatic animals like bluefin tuna. But even that is a bit of a stretch. But one of the things that I found in my work is that wildlife crime comes in all shapes and sizes. You quite literally have people smuggling caterpillar fungus out of Mongolia. You have live, you know, special spiders being smuggled out of Brazil. People collect baby cheetahs. Please don't, by the way. And so one of the challenges you get is that people are simply unaware of the breadth of wildlife crime. It is both a bad thing and a good thing. It's a bad thing insofar as there's less attention to it, so there's less political pressure to motivate governments to step up and take action. It's a good thing insofar as groups like ours who are working on the issue, the criminals aren't as smart. So it's a lot easier to infiltrate their networks. The Mexico case is notwithstanding, what we found is a lot of the criminals, they're less security conscious. And so as a result, it's a little bit easier to infiltrate and wind up networks, which incidentally are similar supply chains and networks that are used to smuggle people, guns, and drugs. But those folks tend to have higher security protocols, whereas people who are just, you know, traveling with a suitcase full of sea cucumbers or fish maw, they're a little less security conscious. But also governments are less aware of these situations. So, for example, if someone goes through customs with 300 grams of dried fish maw in their suitcase, that could just be a gift for a friend. It's for my grandmother. Well, I found a chunk of fish maw in Singapore when we were doing an investigation there a few years ago for $96,000 Canadian for 300 grams of fish.
Whoa.
So suddenly you have a way of transporting large values of money across borders in ways that some customs and law enforcement may not be aware of. So yeah, it's one of those interesting sticky issues. But if people take one thing away from our interview, it would be that crime is targeting a wide range of wildlife animals across the world, and sea cucumbers is one of them.
All right. So what does sea cucumber crime in BC look like?
Yeah. So our paper looked at sea cucumber fisheries between 2015 and 2022. And what was interesting here was actually a lack of cases. So we only found a total of 24 cases. And to find these cases, by the way, we looked through media stories, legal decisions, and police records. Most of the cases were from police records, which to us indicated that those cases weren't sufficiently exciting enough to warrant media attention. What's interesting is we have a big case hitting right now in Nanaimo, and that case just fell outside of the window of our research, so we didn't actually capture that one. I think now there would be a lot more news stories because it's a hot-button topic, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in a few minutes. But what we found was one news story, one legal case, and then 22 cases from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. And most of those cases were administrative. Out here in British Columbia, we had 13 cases total over that time period, and most of them were just people who forgot their license on the day of. That's a $35 fine. You go show your license to DFO a couple days later, everything's kind of taken care of. There was a couple cases involving falsification of records, but the three criminal cases were ones that mostly revolved around people exceeding their daily catches, using prohibited gear, and fishing out of season, those kinds of things. But what was interesting was they weren't as violent or as highly organized as some of the cases we've seen in other countries, which is reassuring. But the problem, of course, is if we're not seeing a lot of cases, it's very hard to know if it's because there aren't a lot of cases or if criminals are simply getting away with it because it's falling off the radar of law enforcement. It's always very hard to tell.
I have a degree in archaeology, and one of the number one rules is the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence, right?
Exactly. And this is one of the challenges with the approach we've taken. We don't have the budget to go into the field. Like in an ideal world, I'd be out with my colleague Gary, who's a drone operator. We'd be looking for drying sites on the roofs of villages in communities where we know there's sea cucumber fishing. And we'd be trying to, you know, correlate that with fishing records and looking for poachers and illegal dry sites. We can't do that right now. So a lot of times we rely on the media stories, which of course becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But our approach has allowed us to better understand the countries that are starting to step up and also to understand some of the modus operandi of criminals. So in our work in Mexico, for example, we uncovered at least two cases where sea cucumbers were stored in wineries in their cellars between seasons so that they fished over their limit 1 year. They could store the sea cucumbers and then reintroduce them into the market the next year using new paperwork. And that was an interesting revelation.
And, I mean, obviously it's just speculation, but do you think that there is more crime in sea cucumber fisheries than is reported?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we know this for sure. And like, so just for a bit more background for folks, in British Columbia, there's both a commercial and a recreational fishery for sea cucumbers. So there is a legal fishery. There's about 30 vessels. Their annual take is, I think, around 614 tons. It's open for 8 weeks of the year, starts in October, and it brings in around like $15 million in value to the BC economy. That's from a couple years ago. And the recreational fishery, folks can have a 12-animal limit. There's a maximum number that you're allowed to take, and there's obviously as well as the First Nations fisheries as well. So basically, like with, for example, the recreational fishery, some of the cases that we found were examples of people fishing over their daily limit. So the recreational limit here in British Columbia is 12. And one of the cases from Sydney in 2015, the person had 527 sea cucumbers on them.
Whoa.
So a little bit higher than 12. My math isn't always that good, but certainly higher than 12. And those people received a $5,000 fine. So you can kind of read between the lines there that that punishment may or may not deter future criminal activity. But yeah, we know that there's a lot of criminal activity going on in fisheries because you have people operating in remote areas. I couldn't speculate on the size of it, but there's definitely people who are probably recreationally fishing over their limits. And for all we know, there's other poachers out there who have larger scale operations. And other countries, we've seen that. One example was in Alaska, where we reported this in our book chapter that had come out on sea cucumber crime. And there was a father and son that were bringing in way more sea cucumbers than anyone else was. And they were just chatting at the bar and someone just looked at their records and it looked like they went right into a protected area, fished the protected area and came back out. And there were a lot of sea cucumbers there because it was a protected area, allowing the populations to recover. So in remote areas or areas where there's just huge coastlines, it's very challenging to do enforcement.
So as you're sort of referencing there, there are protections and there are rules and quotas and protected areas and all that, but these seem to be insufficient to give sort of full protection. Do you have any ideas or thoughts about what could be done to better protect these populations?
There's a range of things. Obviously, ongoing and continued enforcement and monitoring is critical. It's important that governments take these situations seriously. And I think one of the roles that I've had in the movement, the broader narrative and conversation around illegal fishing, has been trying to push governments to understand that illegal fishing is organized crime. So I've already given you some examples of organized crime syndicates involved in sea cucumber fishing. One more example would be the Yakuza in Japan, allegedly in 2018 made more money on sea cucumber operations, illegal sea cucumber operations, than they did selling methamphetamines. Again, no one's had a chance to crack open the books of the Yakuza, so I don't know if that's necessarily true, but there were some interesting news stories on it. So one of the things that I've been trying to do is just to communicate to governments that illegal fishing isn't just an administrative crime. It's not just we're going to give you a small fine, go about your day. It's organized crime. And if you look at international definitions of organized crime, it's more than two people working over a protracted period of time, engaged in organized criminal activity. That's what illegal fishing operations are. And when governments look at them from that lens, suddenly they see people who are stealing from the government by not paying taxes and paying for permits. They're seeing people who are engaged in criminal activities that are linked to other criminal activities, and it ideally motivates them to take action. The other thing, too, is, of course, making sure the punishment fits the crime. So again, with these administrative crimes, they're so often seen as a fine. So the people who were found with 527 sea cucumbers and are fined $5,000, that may or may not be the value of that catch. Like, that may be less than the value of that catch. And if they've been doing that for multiple days, it just becomes part of the cost of doing business. And we've seen this time and time again around the world, where the punishments for wildlife crimes are not as serious as if you steal other things. If someone walks into a bank and steals $10,000, they're going to jail for a protracted period of time. If they steal $10,000 worth of fish, they might just pay a small fine. And that's, of course, a huge problem.
We have mentioned or referred to it earlier, and maybe in terms of consequences for sea cucumber crime or fishery crimes. We've talked about the case of Scott, or referred to the case of Scott Stanley Matthew Steer. What can you tell me about that and what it means for this process?
So right now, as we're speaking, at the beginning of May, Scott Steer, the most notorious sea cucumber poacher in Canadian history, is going through the sentencing at the courts in Nanaimo. So basically, this is the largest Canadian sea cucumber crime, in to my knowledge, in Canadian history. I will couch that insofar as we only looked at cases going up to 2015. So historically, there could be other cases, but I think it's somewhat unlikely. Basically, Scott Steer was someone who was already prohibited from fishing because of previous poaching activity targeting Dungeness crabs, halibut, prawns, and other species. The man was prohibited from being on a fishing vessel until 2038. Yet in March 2020, some people saw a boat off the ferry that was operating without lights, and they reported it to the authorities. The authorities show up, DFO shows up, they give chase. Scott Steer's on board the vessel, throws his cell phone over the side of the boat. He's eventually arrested. 3 days later, DFO sends divers down to retrieve the cell phone. They find the phone and they use the information on it to charge him on at least 6 counts of illegal fishing involving sea cucumbers. But first of all, mad respect to the people in DFO for diving and finding a cell phone under the water. I know many people who've lost their phones off the docks might be thinking, well, maybe I can call my friends at DFO now. But I was, you know, very impressed by that operation itself. But, you know, he was smuggling, you know, over the numbers I'd written down from looking through the court cases were around 87,000 pounds of sea cucumbers, which is close to $1 million Canadian in value, depending on, you know, where you price it out in the supply chain. So that was very eye-opening. And as we speak in Nanaimo, he's going through sentencing. And we should know by the end of the day on May 1st or May 2nd what the actual sentencing will be.
Do you know what the range of potential sentences is?
I don't know. So as a non-lawyer, I couldn't speculate. But this is an interesting case because this isn't his first time, right? Mm-hmm. This is someone that Maclean's magazine described as the most prolific poacher on the West Coast and is well known to law enforcement. And as I mentioned earlier, he's prohibited from, you know, owning and setting foot on a fishing boat until 2038. So my hope would be that the punishment fits the crime as well as the context. But I don't know what the exact sentencing should be.
It's interesting, too, to sort of tying back to what you were saying about fisheries crime and fisheries criminal being sort of less sophisticated in their approach and in their systems. Just reading through the court case filings, you know, he's just openly speaking about these things in Facebook Messenger messages, and there are bins in his garage labeled like sea cucumber and or the name of the business he's selling them to. And it just seems like there is an attitude that no one cares enough to catch me, sort of.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, his wife was a director of a company, and he was actively recruiting, you know, people to work on the boats and do dives with him and collect sea cucumbers. This is something we see time and time again in the industry. Like, one of my favorite stories is I'm all over the online forums of people who sell sea cucumbers with my own Facebook profile because I'm too lazy to set up another one. And I'll have people reach out and try to sell me sea cucumbers, which to me is kind of baffling because, like, all you really need to do is Google my name. And my name is not one of those obscure, it's a name that's easily Googleable.
That's not John Smith.
Yeah, I had someone message me on WhatsApp using my phone number, like my personal phone number that's on my website, which indicates that I work on sea cucumber crime, and they offered to sell me sea cucumbers. And every time I asked them a question, we went back and forth. I was standing in line at a shop, so I'm like, yeah, why not? We'll have a conversation here. Every question I asked them, they were admitting to another crime. So, like, where are the sea cucumbers? India. Well, you can't fish for sea cucumbers in India. How do you get them out of the country? Oh, we ship them out of New Delhi. Well, that's illegal. How do you get them through customs? Oh, well, we report them as a gift and as dried fish products, so you don't pay taxes. Well, that's two crimes right there. How do I pay you? Bitcoin. You know, so the whole thing, this whole interaction is basically someone just admitting to additional crimes. I, of course, send that along to my friends in law enforcement in India, and it's in their hands now. So, yeah, the level of sophistication isn't as much as you'd see in people doing other types of criminal enterprises, but at the same time, it can be quite sophisticated. One of the examples I can draw on is in India, you'll actually have sea cucumbers that are stored for protracted periods of time until they have like enough to do a shipment. They'll bale them up, put a tracking device on them, and drop them out in the ocean, and then another boat will come pick them up afterwards using that same beacon.
Wow.
So it's kind of like a James Bond operation. So there are some sophisticated operations in that way, and also the false labeling and, you know, forged paperwork. Those always involve a lot of effort on the part of criminals.
And that is an indication of the value that is there to be had, right?
And for folks who are listening too, like, we haven't talked about that much, but the most valuable sea cucumber right now that you can buy in the shops in Shangwan and Hong Kong is the Japonicus, the little spiky Japanese sea cucumber. And they sell for around $3,500 per kilogram. That's a lot of money. Now, that's obviously the end product in the markets in Hong Kong. The fishers aren't getting that much for them. The ones we were looking at in Mexico were around a couple dollars per sea cucumber to the fisher, but they're selling for $300-$400 a kilo in Shangwan. So basically, there's money to be made in these. And I think a lot of times we underestimate the value of illicit wildlife products. In addition to sea cucumbers, one of the ones that fascinates me is caterpillar fungus. This is possibly an aside that may be off topic, but you know how there's some mushrooms that take over animals' brains and make them go crazy? Mm-hmm. People have seen The Last of Us now. I think it's become more popular. Before that show came out, I sounded like a bit of a crazy person presenting that. But there's mushrooms that take over animals' brains, and there's a worm that lives in Mongolia. And the mushroom will take over its brain, and it will go to the surface of the grass, and the mushroom pops out of the top of its head. People will crawl across fields to collect these mushrooms. They're only like the size of a pen, maybe half the size of a pen. And they sell for more than platinum. Like, if you look up caterpillar fungus on Amazon, it's like $3,000, $4,000 per 100 grams. Like, it's absolutely baffling how expensive and valuable these products are. And so you can think, there's money to be made. So greed motivates things. And they're also a way of transporting value across borders. So money laundering's at play as well.
Seems to me like eating a fungus that is known for taking over the brain of another animal is not the greatest idea, but...
Yeah. I'm certainly not going to eat them myself. But it is fascinating. Like, when you go down to some of the markets in like Singapore and in Hong Kong, what you see for sale, whether it's Canadian seal penises or, Chatou shawls from endangered ungulate fur, sea cucumber, shark fins, abalone, seahorses is one I see a lot of. You'll have a bottle of wine with seahorses floating in it, and they're almost certainly they don't have CITES papers for export-import. So yeah, it is pretty wild, the sheer scale of wildlife crime and the different species that are targeted and the money that often changes hands.
So beyond sort of awareness of, as you're saying, the scale of wildlife crime, what would you want listeners to take away from this conversation?
I think it's really challenging for a consumer to know where they're getting their food from, but that's very important. So one aspect would just be know what you're eating and where it comes from, if at all possible. But a lot of this, it's so difficult for the consumer to know, like a falsely labeled product or a product that was laundered through legitimate markets. You can't do the research yourself. So really, we need to have pressure on governments to take these things seriously. And that would be my biggest takeaway, would be we need to consider wildlife crime as a serious crime and as a serious form of organized crime. And that needs to motivate governments to assign the necessary resources to tackling this crime. We have these conversations around drug smuggling and the impact that fentanyl has in our communities, and that's a huge issue. And I think a lot of times people are unaware of the fact that that same level of organized crime is being used to devastate ecosystems, whether they're marine or terrestrial. And governments need to be stepping up and taking them as seriously as they do other forms of organized crime.
Right. And regardless of where the money is coming from, what product is being transported or laundered, it's all money funding organized crime, right?
And not only that, it's even more like, yes, and sometimes it's not even money. One example I point out is with abalone in South Africa. There was a triangular trade situation with organized crime groups where they would trade abalone for methamphetamine precursors, and they would trade those for firearms. Hmm. And so no money was changing hands. It was like this barter economy. When we were looking at cases in Mexico, there was some weird cases that came up on our radar where a drug house would be raided and they'd find tons of drugs and then a couple of sea cucumbers and a shark fin. Why were those there? Well, people were exchanging wildlife products for drugs and avoiding the whole cash economy in the first place. So there's all these other layers to it as well. And it just really underscores the importance of considering wildlife crime and impacts on our environment as seriously as we do other forms of organized crime.
Great. Well, thanks, Teal, for joining me today and sharing all of this with our listeners.
It was great talking to you. Yeah, and if folks are interested, the paper is not behind a paywall. It's on the Best American Information Bulletin, and it's Characterizing Canadian Sea Cucumber Fisheries. And I'm looking forward to our next paper. Our next deep dive is going to be into looking at another global review, looking for more hotspots. I suspect we're going to find some more cases in the South Pacific as some of the islands have opened up their fisheries there, but we'll see what happens. And yeah, the Oceans Asia Research Team is always looking for opportunities to help protect marine species.
Great. Thanks again. I'll link to the paper in the show notes here. I did read it. It's academic, but it was a pretty easy read and lots of interesting stuff in there. So thanks again for joining me.
Thanks for reading the paper.
Yeah. Thanks to Teal for joining me for that conversation. We did mention a court case that was sentencing was supposed to happen early May. That has been postponed until July. Find out more information at cgsf.ca, where this episode and